Germany actually has only one viable constructive potential partner on the European continent, and that's Russia. Because, to the east, they have Poland, which is actually antagonistic towards Germany. To the west, they have France, which is also antagonistic to Germany. The Scandinavians are not particularly friendly either. So the Germans are surrounded by nations that are formally allies, but in reality are, bad neighbors and have very little to offer Germany in terms of, security and strategic questions. The only nations with which Germany can actually deal to its benefit, to be able to develop its industries, to ensure its strategic security, is Russia. And so I think it's only a matter of time before Germany reorients itself to Russia, which means exit from NATO.
Alex Craner, good afternoon to you. How are you, my friend?
Very well, Andy. Good to join you again. And my warm greetings to your viewers and listeners.
Yes, well, Happy New Year to you. And just for all those people that are tuning in, Alex and I have been trying to get this done for about a month, but it's been a hectic schedule and sickness and then the holidays and all that. So we haven't been able to, but very much looking forward to this discussion. Since we've talked, Syria is basically completely imploded. Wanted to get your thoughts on where exactly are we at with that? What can you tell me about that? And what's really the next shoe to drop in the Middle East there?
So with regards to Syria, we had the narrative, the conventional narrative, which went along with the whole incursion of HTS into Syria, which started on 27th November. And then I think it was by the 8th of December that Damascus fell without a fight. Assad was out and the moderate head choppers took over. So the whole story never made any sense to me, and I didn't know what exactly was going on, but I did know that the story as presented couldn't be true. It could not have been true. And I also noticed that certain elements of that narrative came into being all of a sudden and all at once, and the few elements of it were Syrian army was so weak and so corrupt, and the soldiers were paid very little, and the military commanders are all corrupt. So, that's why it all imploded. That doesn't make any sense. If for anybody who's ever served in the military, it doesn't matter how badly you're paid. You signed up for a shit deal the day you joined, basically to lay down your life for free. Whether you're paid a lot of money or not a lot of money, it doesn't matter at all. And as I wrote in one of my Substack articles, I remember when I was in the Croatian military and we were at war, my salary was good for four beers out in the town. It was nothing. It was, and it was even it really isn't conceived as a salary. It's a little compensation that you're meant to have to buy, toothpaste and razor blades. It's not. Nobody goes there because they say, like, hey, this salary is a good deal. And so I'm going to defend my country because the money is good. So that didn't make sense. The second part that didn't make sense at all was that it all imploded all at once. So, even if you had very unhappy troops with real serious grievances, it will be worse in some units, better in other units. Some commanders command their troops loyalty. They're good people. Troops will follow them into the fire. Others, not so much. So you would see these. You would see the army collapsing gradually and sporadically here and there. Not everywhere all at once. And then we also started having more and more stories about how horrible Bashar Assad was. You know, he had a big collection of very expensive sports cars. I've seen no evidence of that, and nobody ever mentioned that before. And he was so horrible, everybody hated him. Well, there was no evidence of that even. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, that he was well-respected and well-loved by majority of Syrian people, even among those who vehemently disagreed with him. You know, I think that the majority of people, I could be wrong, but it seems to me from, you know, even from reporting of people on the ground, that he was a respected figure in Syria. And so, because the narrative got spun out so quickly, with completely new element that were getting picked up almost without question, I thought the whole thing must have been a setup. Somehow it was organized, particularly the collapse of the Syrian military. If it all collapsed in the space of 10 days, 11 days, the only way that that could happen is if there were orders given, disband and disperse. And even then, you know, Syrian military was about 270,000 troops under arms, or, you know, the whole organization. Where did they go? You know, that's a lot of people. What did they just vaporize? They must be somewhere. And it's not like it was safe for them to just simply go home with these head choppers overrunning their towns and villages. So I assumed that some parts of the Syrian army must have regrouped. And who knows, maybe they went underground. Maybe over the 8 years since the war in Syria ended in 2016 in December, that they reconsidered and that they maybe concluded that the effective way to fight against the empire, against Israel and its allies, is by going underground, as Hamas have done, as Hezbollah has done. So maybe parts of the Syrian military did exactly that. And then, you know, over the last 6 weeks since all this happened, bits and pieces of information came out, which to me suggest that what I initially thought in broad brush terms was probably on the right track. Namely, we found out that the Russians not only got Bashar al-Assad out of Damascus, but one of his top generals. And you know, this story is they went and they got the man and they got him out. Another general, together with Bashar al-Assad's brother, took a whole tank division over to Iraq. And so they regrouped there. And then apparently Syria's very best troops withdrew into the mountains around Latakia. And there they are still very much a viable force. And they have apparently already been attacking the units of HTS and their friends. So Syria will continue to be a mess. But let me get to the reasons why I thought that this might have been done. Because I thought, okay, so let's say orders must have been given for the military to disband. Why? It must be for a reason. It wouldn't be just like, let's let them have Syria, right? The reason, to my mind, must be of the highest strategic order. And to understand that, we have to understand that, you know, Israel was created in that region by the British Empire. That is, the British Empire is where the Balfour Declaration originates from, right? It was written by Britain's then Foreign Minister Arthur Balfour in a letter to Rothschild. Now, his first name escapes me, but Basically, it happened in 1917, so more than 100 years ago. The preparation for this go even farther in time. So, and the reason was because the British Empire understood that this region, the Eastern Mediterranean, was particularly important, and that the Middle East was very rich with oil resources. And they understood that oil was the future for industry because, back in those days, the oil industry was whaling, right? The whalers all around the world killing whales and squeezing the oil out of the whales, which means, there was only so much to go around, and the oil underground was understood to be the future of energy, and not just for lighting, but also for industrial production, energy production, and so forth, cars. And so they wanted to control the region. So they created Israel as a beachhead to control that part of the world. And the intellectual and strategic power were British think tanks, primarily the Round Table, Alfred Milner's Round Table, which was later renamed to Royal Society of International Affairs, and later to Chatham House. And then you're in succession of going from, Cecil Rhodes, Alfred Milner, and then, one of their disciples ultimately, you have Henry Kissinger, and one of his disciples was Zbigniew Brzezinski. And now you have people like the neocons and the Kagans, Victoria Nuland, Wes Mitchell. All of these people keep banging about the same drum of maintaining the hegemony over the Eurasian landmass. And the strategy always has been to create this arc of crisis that which stretches from the Baltics down to the Eastern Mediterranean, and then across the whole southern Russian underbelly all the way up to the Koreas. And the British Empire has seeded that whole belt with potential crisis flashpoints, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Greece, Turkey, Syria, Israel, Lebanon, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, then Balochistan. Then you have on the other side, on the eastern end of India, you have Bangladesh, where we recently had a regime change operation. Then you have Myanmar, which is another. And then you have ultimately the Koreas, which have been purpose divided into two, that you can always try to detonate some kind of a war there. So, the way to maintain hegemony over the Eurasian landmass is to always do the divide and conquer, to provoke military conflicts. And this is exactly the purpose that Israel was meant to serve. And at the time, the Alfred Milner's disciples were talking about the need to seed this area with a particularly, they didn't say fanatical, the word they used was patriotic stock. Right. And this is how and why Israel was created. So I think that when we go back to Syria, I think that the new powers on the Eurasian landmass, i.e., China, Iran, and Russia, must have decided to end this whole century of British geopolitics, which has pretty much entailed permanent warfare. And in order to do that, they had to pacify the Middle East, which probably entails elimination of Israel in its current form. So Israel is probably going to have to, the two-state solution is over and done with. That's not coming back. And so we're going to probably end up having a one-state solution. In what form and how, we don't know yet, but we do see that in the last 6 weeks, things have already started evolving out of control. Kind of, you have in the north conflict between Turkey and the Kurds, And both the Kurds and the Turks are nominally allies of the United States. So the United States has found itself in a very delicate and difficult position. How do you juggle that, you know, conflict? And then we've seen that Turks have made kind of aggressive, their posturing towards Israel has become aggressive and borderline hostile. And this has been taken extremely seriously by the Israeli leadership, who now have upgraded Turkey into their biggest and most dangerous enemy rather than Iran. You know, the Iran has been relegated to the second place. And at the same time, you know, the Houthis and Hamas continue to pound Israel. So they didn't, you know, 6 weeks ago, I said I thought that Israel scored a very Pyrrhic victory there. It looks nice in the same way that the United States walking into Kabul in 2002 looked nice, and them walking into Baghdad in 2003 looked nice. Well, you know, 20 years later, it doesn't look so nice anymore. You know, it was a very, very costly triumph that led to a strategic defeat ultimately, and I think that this is exactly what Israel scored here. And with regards to the Western powers, like the United States, the UK, and you know, various members of the European Union, like France and Germany, other countries have less involvement. They're going to score a strategic defeat there, and I think that what that's going to mean concretely, and this is important to understand, is it's not going to be that you're not going to have oil at the pumps anymore. You know, because oil gets to your pumps one way or another. You know, if there's demand, you're gonna get the oil. Maybe it's gonna be a question of price, but you know, the oil supply can go on. The problem is that I think that the Western financial system implodes. Why? Because they no longer control the collateral. The resource wealth of these various parts of the world have to be controlled by force, because they are, in large part, they're the collateral of the Western financial system. It's on the basis of that collateral that they issued hundreds of billions of loans to, you know, the likes of BP, Royal Dutch Shell, Halliburton, KBR, you know, you name it, thousands of corporations. And it's based on the business that they have in the region that they are repaying those loans, right? So those assets, which have been extremely lucrative and profitable for the Western financial industry, are now slipping away. And so you're going to be getting more and more bad debts. And the only way you can backstop that is by printing currency at this point, or letting all those companies and banks go bust, which is not what they're going to allow happen. So they're going to have to be printing currency ad infinitum. And I think that the results for the Western powers is going to be, in the case of Europe, Britain, Japan, it's going to be stagflation for years, which will very likely accelerate into a hyperinflation. So inflation is going to be accelerating. And then with respect to the United States, I think that the United States has a much, much greater maneuvering space. So inflation is going to be inevitable. But in the case of the United States, maybe it won't be stagflation. Maybe the United States will muster some good economic growth because it can. You know, it can attract a lot of capital back home. It can restart industrialization. It can use a lot of this capital to renovate its stock of infrastructure. You know, its infrastructure stock. You know, the bridges are falling down, the railroads are falling down, you know, you name it. There's a lot of work to be done, and there's a lot of capital with which that work can be done. And so I think with the Trump administration that there's a good chance that they're going to ramp up the economic machine that is going to hum along. That's not going to save the dollar. But, you know, if people are working and the economy is producing goods and services, people are okay. Everybody's savings are going to go to zero or close to, but there's going to be work, there's going to be bread, there's going to be food, and there's going to be stuff in the stores. In Europe, I think we're going to see a much more serious crisis, much more serious crisis with not only inflation, but also a recession at the same time.
Wow. So you haven't disappointed.
Sorry, that was long, but you asked, so.
No, you didn't disappoint, by all means. But I mean, I was writing notes furiously, some questions and some observations that you can elaborate on. My first question, and if I could get three questions in here.
Sure.
Is what's the next, do you see, and this is very, very hard to predict, I get that, and this is not a prediction, but what do you see as the next shoe to drop then, a la Syria in the Middle East, or if there is a next shoe to drop? The second question is, you've seen, since we've last talked, well, in December, all this happens simultaneously, it seemed like, Germany basically imploded. Is that, and how is that related? And you touched on that in what you just said about really the Western financial markets, if you want to paraphrase, seizing and plumping. So it seems to me that that is related. And then the third it is a question, but it's also an observation. Do you see money? You talked about the U.S. Do you see potential money flowing back to the U.S. because relative strength versus the rest of the world and relative stability, if that makes sense?
Okay, so going back to the next shoe to drop, there's been a lot of talk that the next shoe to drop would be Iran because, you know, people kind of extrapolated that whole Wesley Clark prediction of we're going to take down seven nations in 5 years. He made that prediction 20 years ago, so it hasn't been exactly correct, even though out of those seven nations, six have been taken down. So people say like, well, you know, this is an unstoppable force, and the only country on that list that hasn't been taken down is Iran. So therefore, you know, Iran's going to be the next shoe to drop. But, you know, the strategic situation in the region has changed, and it's changed irreversibly, and it's changed radically in the sense that, you know, United States had two levers of power in that region. One was reliance on its allies, which were many, you know, Egypt, Jordan, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, minus Iran, and Turkey. All of these alliances are either no longer or they're very, very wobbly, with exception of Israel. Jordan and Egypt may be solid, but those regimes themselves are extremely wobbly. So that lever of power is turned into a wet noodle. And then the other lever of power was what they call the force projection, which means, you know, you would, if there was some uppity regime in the region or anywhere in the world who thought that they could defy the empire, well, the United States would just send one of their carrier strike groups. And that would generally intimidate other nations into complying with the diktats of the empire. Well, you know, meanwhile, we have these hypersonic missiles, which are now, you know, it's not only Russia that has them, but Iranians have them. And apparently, Ansarallah in Yemen also has them. And these missiles are capable of destroying carrier strike groups, or at the very least, debilitating them to the point where they are useless. So that lever of power has also turned into a wet noodle. And then, you know, this beachhead in the Middle East named Israel hasn't got a snowball's chance in hell of surviving without the financial and military support from the United States. And now we know that the United States is a paper tiger. So, you know, the Netanyahu regime in Israel has been desperate to get the United States to go and kill Iran for them. But they can't. They just simply cannot. Iran is very strong. They can sink. any of the American carrier strike groups that come within the reach of their missiles. And they have air defense, you know, unlike Libya and Syria and all these other countries. And so, short of dropping a lot of nukes on Iran, there's nothing that the United States can do to help Israel in this respect. So, dropping nukes on Iran, I'm not sure what that accomplishes other than, you know, wreaking destruction and killing a lot of people. Yeah, exactly. It would be destructive on many levels for the West as well. So will they dare? I don't see it, you know. I really don't see it. I'm sure that Israelis would, but Israelis on the other hand aren't going to do anything unless Washington lets, you know. Israeli leadership doesn't go to the toilet without the Americans okaying them. And that's another thing that I think is misperceived in the West, because everybody thinks that Israel controls the United States. I don't think that's exactly true. It's not. The United States doesn't control Israelis either in terms of strategy and ideology, but it does control them in terms of purse, money, and weaponry. So right. if the flow of weapons stops, well, you know, the Israelis are pretty much stuck. They don't have enough weaponry to fight Hamas, the Ansarallah, Hezbollah, the Iranian proxy forces, the Iranians, and now potentially even Turks and HTS. So it's too overwhelming. I think that they have really painted themselves in the corner. So to answer the shoes that might drop in the near future, I'm not going to say Israel, but I will say potentially NATO and the EU, because there things have started shaking up so badly now. And I think that they're going to unravel much faster than we think. We already have the Slovaks and the Hungarians and the Romanians in a nearly open rebellion. We have, you know, we just had a vote in Croatia about a month ago and the second round yesterday again. The guy that they tried to disqualify and defeat because they lambasted him as Putin's stooge in Croatia, he just won 73% of the popular vote in second round of presidential elections. It's brutal. It's really brutal. And, you know, today he gave a statement, and well, you know, he's a president of the country. He's not going to speak like Boris Johnson with F words and vulgarity, but he did say that the European Union is being led by people who are not elected and not accountable to anybody. That is, they're not accountable to the European people. Mm-hmm. So there's a crisis of legitimacy. When there's crisis of legitimacy, how are you going to send troops to fight somewhere? You know, if you want to go escalate the war against Russia and say, okay, well, you know, Ukraine seems to be defeated for all practical purposes. Now we need to mobilize the Romanians and the Poles and the Croats and the Slovaks and Hungarians and so forth. Well, you know, if in all those countries people think that you're not legitimate, they're just not going to go. And so now you have, you know, the political structures are now largely hollow forms across Europe. And in places like Romania and Germany and France, that's become so apparent and so glaringly obvious to the people living in those countries that I think it's only a matter of time when we get some kind of a big change. And the big change could be, you know, in Germany, you now have both the dominating parties on the left, on the right, who are saying, we need to reconnect Nord Stream 2. We got to do this. And, you know, Olaf Scholz himself has seen the writing on the wall, so he's trying to get a meeting with Putin. I said, you know, when this war in Ukraine started, I wrote in my newsletter that Germany actually has only one viable constructive potential partner on the European continent, and that's Russia. Because, you know, to the east, they have Poland, which is actually antagonistic towards Germany. To the west, they have France, which is also antagonistic to Germany. The Scandinavians are not particularly friendly either. So the Germans are surrounded by nations that are formally allies, but in reality are, you know, bad neighbors and have very little to offer Germany in terms of, you know, security and strategic questions. The only nations with which Germany can actually deal to its benefit, to be able to develop its industries, to ensure its, you know, strategic security, is Russia. And so I think it's only a matter of time before Germany reorients itself to Russia, which means exit from NATO. AfD already wants to exit NATO and the European Union. And then, you know, the dominoes are going to go. Hungary, Slovakia, Romania, Croatia. You might be able to pull a whole line from the Baltics down to the Mediterranean, and you could really get a whole chunk of EU that's going to defect. Yeah. So my guess would be that that's the next shoe to drop. Only, you know, we'll find out.
So I want to talk about that just briefly. That is a great point and something I actually thought about just throughout the past month, but then just really recently, just about all of the, is just reading about what's going on in Romania and then also Croatia about just the anti-NATO sentiment, if you would. And I thought, I wonder if NATO is the next shoe to drop. So great point. Tie this into Germany, which you probably already did. What's going to happen now? Okay, so Germany's making overtures to Russia because they don't have friendly neighbors. The German economy is completely imploding. Yeah, I mean, work that out for me there. What's going to happen in Germany?
All things being equal, I think that Germany would gradually move away from the pro-Atlanticist camp into, let's say, some kind of a sovereigntist camp, and then they would probably start, you know, shed the sanctions against Russia, start trading, reconnect the Nord Stream 2. But
is the EU?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, you know, EU has been a massive train wreck lately, and I think that people are losing this delusion that EU is somehow this good club to be with. I'll give you the example of Croatia again. As a Croatian, we entered the EU finally in 2013. I can guarantee you that if you asked ordinary people on the street in Croatia, do you feel that you're better off today or worse off today than 11 years ago? Maybe it won't be 100%, but it'll be a massive majority of people will tell you, no, this is way, way worse. Everything's turned to shit. You know, excuse the expression, but, you know, the infrastructure, we never had homeless people. We have homeless people now. The post office barely works. The water distribution system is crap. It's almost everything that made the society function for the benefit of the majority of ordinary people living there is faltering, and everything is being turned over to is being privatized and turned over to public capital, which is, you know, pretty much loads it up with debt and then abandons it to itself. And so it's not working. And, you know, 65% of people in Croatia or more can't seem to make ends meet at the end of the month. And for Europe, according to Eurostat, for the, you know, the whole of EU, it's 45%. So 45% of the population of the European Union, you know, 450 million people, can't seem to make ends meet. So it's not this club of advanced living, prosperity, human rights, blah, 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 all these nice things that they sold us on. So I think there's no nostalgia there. And when you see this sharp deterioration of everything on the back of anti-Russian sanctions, as the Germans have seen, then you think like, okay, so it's very obvious what we have to do. You know, we have to end these sanctions. We need to reconnect Nord Stream pipelines, and we need to get back to producing things and bringing jobs back. You know, it'll take jumping off from the EU train because the EU and the ECB, the European Central Bank, have, if not deliberately, but they have drastically undermined German competitiveness. Germany used to be the world's number one exporting powerhouse. And I'm not talking about relative to the size of the GDP or the size of the population. I'm talking in absolute terms. Germany exported more than China until about 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And there was a reason for that. You know, they had the world's best banking system. Their banks supported local, regional, industrial production. You had multi-generational family businesses that perfected whatever they were making, good services. And they had, as a result, they had among the world's most efficient and most competitive output, which found abundant market on the world marketplace. This is now all being destroyed. The small and regional banks are being destroyed, which is being done deliberately and actively by the ECB. The banking system is being consolidated on the British model, where you have pretty much 90% of all the deposits in Britain are controlled by the five biggest banks. These five biggest banks only finance the biggest companies in Britain. So there's no capital going to small and medium-sized businesses, family-owned businesses. And those are everywhere in the world, everywhere in the world. It's a known thing based on some, you know, studies based on something like 70 market-oriented countries around the world, that small and medium-sized businesses generate something like 80% of all employment. They are the driver of innovation, of competitiveness, of new products and services that can compete on the global marketplace. And that is being deliberately destroyed in favor of large corporate systems. In other words, we have essentially a form of Sovietization of Europe. Yeah. And, you know, the result is that we're going to go the way of the Soviet Union. It's going to go until it can't no longer. The only difference is that, you know, the Union, the European Union itself is much, much looser than the Soviet Union was. So, you know, rather than there being a sudden collapse at a given point in time, like we had with Soviet Union in 1991, there might be an unraveling of the political union itself, and then countries just going their ways. And I think that when the war in Ukraine is ended, when it ends, I think that the Russians will round out their control of the Black Sea coast, meaning that they're going to take control of Odessa, whether militarily or otherwise. I think it's going to be probably in some administrative way. And at that point, you know, they control the Danube flow into the Black Sea. And at that point, countries like Hungary and Bulgaria and Romania, well, Bulgaria and Romania are not landlocked, but countries like Austria and Hungary and Slovakia and Serbia, they have an out. They can no longer be sanctioned and blackmailed easily by the EU. And so that, that radically changes the strategic equation on the continent. And then I think we're going to start to see the first countries go their own way. And I think that I don't know if Germany might be one, because I said, you know, like I said, all things being equal, but you know, this is the territory when you start to have political assassinations. Because, you know, back in 1991 or two, I forget, or maybe 89 even, or 88, one of those years, I don't remember. There was the CEO of the German bank, Deutsche Bank, a very powerful man. His name was Alfred Herrhausen. He had a very different vision of how, you know, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, how Germany should position itself vis-a-vis Russia. And he foresaw this, you know, Russian resources, German technology, working together to create a very, very powerful, very prosperous and advanced bloc, or if not bloc, at least a cooperation.
Right.
And, well, you know, he was assassinated for his troubles.
Yeah.
So the people who are defending the current, let's call it security architecture in the world, will not hesitate to orchestrate coups, assassinations, cancel elections, introduce military dictatorship. They just tried to do that in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And provoke other types of wars, escalations, false flag attacks. So we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. I think that of the European countries, I think that maybe the first shoe to drop, I mean, the first country to exit after Britain could be Hungary, because in Hungary, what Orban did, he understood, you know, he understood the lay of the land. And I think that, I forget when it was. It was a year or two ago, maybe.
I think it was a year ago.
Yeah, he sacked something like 100 and some military generals, the ones that were closest to NATO, because, you know, they're the ones who could threaten the constitutional order and orchestrate a coup and take over power overtly or covertly. So he did a purge. So I think that he gave himself most maneuvering space in that sense. Whereas, you know, Germany, unfortunately, is still an occupied country. It has military bases on its territory, and its intelligence services are, I think, completely in cahoots with the transatlantic Western Empire.
Yeah, I would agree. Very interesting. And it's like trying to, and again, it's tricky because you're trying to, there's so many moving parts, it's almost impossible to say this is what's going to happen next, but because it's just so many moving parts. But it does sense, if you would, and I would agree, it's such an interesting point. The implosion of NATO, more or less, will more than likely, I think, be the next implosion. And then Germany, with its seizing of its economy, if they leave, that's basically the biggest economy in the EU. The EU is over. So I have to leave here, but I wanted, thank you so much for your time. If you could give out how people can find you, and I want to have you on again soon, and we can discuss the other ramifications of this in my last question. But how do people find you? And again, you're become so well known anyways, it's without further ado. But go ahead and give your Substack address.
Well, thank you. So people can find me on X. My handle is @NakedHedgie. And I have two publications of Substack. One is for traders and investors. It's called iSystem Trend Compass. That goes out every day with CTA trend following signals on 16 different global markets. The other one where I write less frequently, but let's say maybe more refined articles that I work on longer, is my personal Substack called Alex Craner's Substack, I think. Yeah.
Maybe it's, I believe so.
Okay, I changed its name, you know, so I'm not entirely, but yeah, it's called Alex Craner's Substack, and that's where I publish, you know, more general stuff concerning history and geopolitics and economics and stuff like that. So, yeah, those three are the main platforms where I'm present.
Well, excellent, Alex. I will put all of this in the show notes, and I do just want to give you the biggest shout out. I'm sure this video will do exceptionally well and get the word out about you and just your thoughts. A lot of thoughts that I share, and congratulations to you. You've become very in demand and very known. All good things and appropriately so. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy. I appreciate that. And until the next time, all the best.
Yeah, all the best. Thank you.
Take care.